You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. Welcome to our second podcast here from the Global Security Studies Program at the School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. I'm Mark Stout, director of the program, the MA program in Global Security Studies, and I'm delighted to have sitting in my office today David Ukko, associate professor at the College of International Security Affairs at the National Defense University here in Washington, D.C. The subject of our discussion today will be a book he has just written, which is coming out, I believe, October 15th from Columbia University Press. He's written it with Robert Egnell, a visiting professor in the Security Studies program across town at Georgetown University. And the book is Counterinsurgency and Crisis, Britain and the Challenges of Modern Warfare. So, David, welcome here to Johns Hopkins University.
Thank you very much.
So, just briefly, why is counterinsurgency in crisis?
Well, I think the Afghan war has a lot to do with it. And there was a period during the so-called surge in Iraq where counterinsurgency was looked at as the least bad option at a very strategically fraught moment. But, of course, any attempt to replicate a semblance of success in Afghanistan has been, if anything, far more fraught. And at this point, there's simply very little enthusiasm to talk about counterinsurgency, to invest in counterinsurgency capabilities, or really to glean or unpick the lessons from the last 10, 15 years of operations. That, to me, is a very troubling reality, one that motivated in part the writing of this book.
How did you come to write this book? Do you want to tell a little bit more about how you and Robert, who unfortunately couldn't join us today, launched on this project?
Sure. I mean, for myself, I'd written a book previously about the U.S. military and counterinsurgency, and what was interesting to me was that the U.S. came to counterinsurgency quite reluctantly. I mean, the idea about the U.S. military is that it always wants to fight and win the nation's wars, but swiftly and decisively and ideally using a very sort of highly technology-driven approach. The British case, on the other hand, and this is partly what motivated me, they've always been seen as the masters of counterinsurgency, low-tech, community-oriented, able to unpick the political complexity of whatever campaign they might be involved in. Yet, of course, as it became clearer that the situation in Basra and then the situation in Helmand didn't quite follow the script, I thought it would be interesting to see why that was. And, of course, rather than just rub salt in the wounds of those people involved in those campaigns, Britain, the case of Britain, also offered a very valuable case study, I believe, for other middle-powered states in Europe and elsewhere for how to really balance expeditionary ambitions with limited resources, particularly in a time of austerity. And as a final reason, much of what we know about counterinsurgency is built on the British record or the British key texts on the topic from the mid-20th century, even earlier. So if the British legacy of counterinsurgency was in some way problematic, then I think it behooves us to study those problems quite seriously so as we don't base our own capabilities on a mythologized past.
Would it be fair to say that, obviously, British counterinsurgency thinking is built on British foundations, but would it also be fair to say that American military thinking about counterinsurgency, taking your point that America, the United States, has never been tremendously enthused about counterinsurgency, but that American thinking on counterinsurgency is also largely built on British foundations?
I think so. I mean, I think the British and the French, I think, have a little bit of responsibility each. Galula, of course, was unearthed very much by the writers of FM3-24.
That's the counterinsurgency manual that David Petraeus is so famous for.
Exactly. And but on the British side, you have a larger canon of experts or sort of practitioners and thinkers. Thompson, of course, Kitson, Templer, and Briggs, and so on. Many of these names you'll see populated in the key text of counterinsurgency, and many of the principles that they wrote of on the basis of their operational experiences are those that you'll find again in FM3-24, the latest U.S. Counterinsurgency manual.
So what then are the British, or the foundations of British counterinsurgency thinking? You know, you've alluded to some of the key authors, but what experiences or lessons are they capturing, and what wars and conflicts are they drawing on? I think it would be fair to say that you characterize this, and I've seen others make this point as well, that you know, the basis and experience here that really all this body of thought is built on is actually fairly narrow and arguably unrepresentative. So what are the basic content of these foundations?
Well, I mean, I guess the simplest way of answering that question would be to just enumerate the principles that keep on being repeated again and again. And they do sound a little bit trite when listed in that manner, but I shall have a go anyway. We're talking about things like maintaining political primacy in any sort of counterinsurgency campaign that you're involved in. That's to say that letting the political direction guide military action rather than the other way around. We're talking about using intelligence to guide operations. We're talking about separating insurgents from the people to provide security for the people and to isolate, not just physically, but also cognitively or politically, the insurgents from that mass. We're talking about chasing the or defeating the insurgency rather than necessarily the insurgents. The insurgents can replenish their ranks, but the insurgency, if you hit the political basis for the legitimacy of that insurgency movement, then you're more likely to meet some sort of success. So there are those types of principles and many others, and of course the exact wording will differ depending on the source. Really, I think the contribution of these principles is an area of some discussion, or should be an area of some discussion.
How so?
Well, to be quite honest, they're not principles that apply narrowly to counterinsurgency. Really, they should apply to any military confrontation. The notion of using intelligence, the notion of having a political objective, I mean, there's nothing that Klaus would disagree with.
I was going to say, that does sound vaguely familiar.
Right, exactly. So it's a little bit strange that counterinsurgency has laid exclusive claim to these principles. I believe that they have far, far greater relevance. What counterinsurgency has done, however, is to put them all in one place, and in that way, really offer a response to or an antithesis to the traditional military-type thinking that one sees maybe predominantly in the West, thinking of war as a primarily apolitical activity where the side that's still standing when the last bullet's fired is the one who wins. I mean, we really, I think, popularly in our films, but also in our literature and our understanding of war, are still very much enchanted by a conventional, militarily decisive understanding of the phenomenon. Role credits, that's the type of thing. The political consolidation hasn't received as much attention. So what the principles do is really put the emphasis on precisely that. We're fighting for a political solution. Military means are necessary but in themselves insufficient. Remember that you are only one bit player of a larger multi-agency or interagency or multinational response. And in that sense, the contribution is in one sense very modest, but in another way also very important, particularly given the orthodoxies of the militaries that have been most involved in these types of endeavors.
Now, would it be fair to say that the British derived these principles very largely on the basis of the conflict in Malaya and the insurgency in Northern Ireland?
Those two campaigns have a very large role in the legacy of British counterinsurgency, that's for sure. You don't really hear of the other ones, whether they're successful or not. I mean, for example, the campaign in Dhofar could arguably be said to have been a success, but you haven't really heard a lot about it until very recently. So Northern Ireland and Malaya absolutely are the two key campaigns. And Malaya, I think, it's a little bit bizarre how much time and energy we spend talking about this 12-year campaign from the 1950s that, for all intents and purposes, should be as obscure as anything else that happened around that time.
Well, I was going to ask you, how did these cases come to be the ones that were remembered?
I think Britain
has a rich history of this sort of thing.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, I think one reason is that some of the practitioners involved, particularly Thompson, for example, but also Kitson, their writing was based in part or wholly on these campaigns. So they became immediately more prominent within historiography. And then, of course, the fact that Malaya was so soon before Vietnam, I believe, played a role in popularizing that campaign within the American military audience. I mean, Thompson was an advisor in Vietnam, for better and for worse. But I think more recently, of course, a lot of... I think John Nagle has played a very large role in his book, Eating Soup with a Knife, in which he compared the British approach in Malaya with the U.S. approach in Vietnam. I mean, that book's publication, I believe, was in 2004, just as the U.S. military was starting to grapple with the problem of insurgency, has really pushed
Malaya. Insurgency in Iraq.
Insurgency in Iraq, that's right. Pushed Malayan campaign right to the forefront, where I think if you asked people in 2002 about that particular campaign, you'd probably get a lot of very curious looks.
So to the extent then that the British thinking and by derivation American thinking is largely dependent on Malaya, the experience in Malaya and Northern Ireland, do you have any sense of, are those really representative cases or are they outliers? So is this, let me put it this way, is that an intellectually unsound basis or is it perfectly okay, it just happens to be a narrow basis?
I think both cases are deeply problematic if we seek to find solutions for example, Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere else for that matter. I mean, just the very fact that they happened a very long time ago, particularly, of course, in the Malayan campaign that was concluded in 1960, but really, I mean, had the insurgency had failed many years before then, it's very difficult to draw direct lessons from there and then to now and here. What I would say is they are helpful, much like any other case, if you look more at the principle of the matter rather than the exact practice. And what Malaya does in particular is that it offers a case study of a campaign with a strategic, operational, and tactical activity when not perfect, but in very good congruence. And that is that's a fairly mean feat, something we haven't exactly been adept at replicating since then. What I mean by that is strategically, let's start with the tactical and operationally. We hear a lot about the jungle warfare and the jungle craft and the new villages and the way in which the British and the Commonwealth soldiers were able to outfox the guerrillas or out-guerrilla the guerrillas or provide opportunities for their people and so on and so forth. I mean, this is many books have been written on those topics. So tactically and operationally, under Briggs and then Templar, the British came to a very fruitful way of interacting or behaving. But of course, none of that would have mattered at all had the strategic direction of the campaign been at odds with what was going on the ground. By the time that Britain tried to withdraw...
So just to interrupt to make sure I understand, you're making the point there that strategy basically, is ultimately more important than operations and tactics. That, you know, with if you have good strategy but poor operational operations and tactics, you have a chance of muddling through, but the reverse is not true.
I think that's probably true, though of course the best case scenario is when your operations actually contribute to your strategy or are informed by that strategy. I mean, for example, if you look at it, this is counterfactual and maybe a little bit misleading, but if the British had the same strategic directions, say independence and a multi-ethnic democratic state, yet the operations were those conducted in Kenya at the simultaneous campaign, but where the methods were far more brutal, it's questionable to me whether you'd have the same outcome, because of course that in itself would be highly inflammatory. But what you did have instead was a strategic and operational congruence that led then to a fairly, in relative sense, happy outcome for that particular campaign. So Malaya is a case study in how some of the principles that we spoke of previously can be applied. That's not to say that we can repeat the practices of the campaign, but we can certainly try to replicate the principles. Again, intelligence, separating insurgents from the enemies, and we can't do forced relocation of people.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the principles separating the population from the enemy, and if I understand correctly, that was literally done physically by forced, as you say, forced relocation of the civilians, or many of the civilians in Malaya. That would not go over well in today's CNN age.
Right.
Would have all sorts of negative connotations. And I would fully agree with probably most of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is a different strategic time, different level of media penetration, and there's some things that we simply cannot or would not want to do. But there's still, of course, an undeniable utility to separating insurgents from civilians. So how do we deal with that conundrum? Well, maybe we talk about separation in a less physical sense. That's to say, we try to, through intelligence works or whatever, to establish who is whom, and we don't just conflate them all together, as is often the case in the early years of counterinsurgency, where fear, frustration leads to a very sort of monolithic view of the enemy as all those around us. So that you can interpret it that way. But also, if you look at the Iraq case, the use of berms, checkpoints, walls, the way of gaining a population control, which is, of course, one of the key terms of counterinsurgency is still very much with us. The techniques of reaching that objective are very different, and there's things that we can't do that we wouldn't want to do now that happened before, but I think that the ultimate objective is still somewhat relevant and valuable.
Do you want to comment briefly on Northern Ireland? How did that contribute, or what was the British experience there, and how did that contribute to the creation of this body of thought?
Well, it's interesting when we speak about the sensitivities of the day and the ways in which we are no longer operating as we used to. Northern Ireland is sort of a midway point, a bridge, if you will, because, of course, Britain felt that it could not quite do what it did in the colonies in Northern Ireland because it was too close to home, and these were, after all, sort of, Europeans or, countrymen or whatever. So
it was part of the United Kingdom.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It was their country.
Right, yeah. So even more so. So what happened in Northern Ireland was an attempt over time, and I have to stress over time because initial years don't quite confirm this point, to refine some of the principles and practices to a much more sensitive and politically volatile situation. And, of course, many of the books written about Northern Ireland would stress the use of intelligence or the way in which the police gradually gained primacy and tried to sort of normalize the situation that way. Those learnings can be made relevant to our operations today when there's always the glare of the stare media, and we have, an environment in which one has to tread very carefully. I mean, the whole idea of a tactical action gaining strategic implications, I think, is quite fair. But, of course, Northern Ireland is limited in its instructiveness also by the fact that logistically and culturally and ethnically and politically, the level of awareness of those troops going there and also the other security forces and intelligence operators is, of course, much higher than we'll have anywhere else. This is essentially, you could call it a domestic issue, whereas, of course, we're talking about expeditionary counterinsurgency.
So, in other words, the people in Northern Ireland spoke the same language, lived their lives in the same way, and physically looked and dressed the same, basically, as the British soldiers who were there to fight the insurgency. So that So the soldiers had some intrinsic understanding of many of the cultural nuances that would not have been the case in Dhofar or Malaya,
right?
Or
Kenya. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you can find some continuity with some of the other colonial campaigns because the Brits had been there for so long. So you may have had some sort of entrenched experience or whatever. But certainly, today, in this day and age, when Britain goes off to and claims the four southern provinces of Iraq as theirs, that's a very different proposition than doing patrols in Belfast.
One of the things that the British are known for is sort of a very sort of soft velvet glove kind of approach, and I'm sure this is a caricature, but it's at least to some extent actually true. To what extent does that actually reflect the genuine British historical experience with practicing counterinsurgency? Were they, in fact, always, by the standards of the time, the nice counterinsurgents?
That's an excellent question, and one that is receiving a lot of attention these days. David French wrote a book not too long ago called, I think, The British Way. Douglas Porch has written a book just now on counterinsurgency. And, of course, John Gentile has written one as well. All of them seek to change our perception of precisely that, of Britain as being the sort of the kinder, gentler counterinsurgency force. That wave of literature needs to be seen as an antithesis to a previous wave of literature that did tend to promote an idea of Britain being a sort of kinder, gentler force that was more attuned to the political context and therefore sought through politics and negotiation to reach objectives rather than through sort of sheer brute force. The truth of the matter, of course, is that both waves of scholarship have done some good in refining understanding of the historical track record, but if their aim is to suggest a standard or consistent approach that goes between cases and across cases, I think that there's a danger of being entirely too totalizing in our understanding. One of the main points that we draw out when we discuss the historiography of the British counterinsurgency campaigns is that really there's a need, as boring as it may seem, to look not just at specific campaigns, but also within specific campaigns to highlight exactly how coercion was fused to co-option in each particular case. It's difficult to say anything general or broad about Britain's approach to counterinsurgency. I mean, just the very fact that Kenya differs in so many regards from Malaya, and both campaigns happened at the same time, virtually, highlights the diversity of action and diversity of policies made. I would say this, in Malaya in particular, much less so in Kenya, there were instances alongside actions of coercion and force where the political or the governance-related aspects of the insurgency were taken quite seriously. And of course, I think for understandable reasons, those aspects were lifted and underlined or emphasized in much of the early history on the campaign because it was so unusual. You didn't tend to see this all over the place. So arguably, perhaps, they were overstated. And that, of course, has led then to the backlash by David French and others. But I think going forward, we should probably take both of these groups of literature but really try to focus more on specific cases and not sort of mythologize something or come with these sort of sweeping generalizations about an approach that really applies across space and time.
So let's talk about the 2000s. The United States, with a fairly substantial coalition at its side, notably including Great Britain, goes to Afghanistan. And then a few years later, with a rather modest coalition, but also with the United Kingdom at its side, goes to Iraq. And before too tremendously long in both cases, the United States and its partners find themselves facing insurgencies in both countries. What was the British view of how the United States forces were conducting their counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, Iraq, even though you're quite correct in pointing out that they went into Afghanistan first, Iraq was, of course, where the word insurgency really first sort of reared its head. And I don't think it's any secret that, and certainly our research bears out, that the British, by and large, thought the U.S. were extremely trigger-happy, very much convinced of the utility of force. You know, and this is not the first time we heard these sorts of ideas. Even in the Balkans, there was a notion of the U.S. soldiers as ninja turtles or as robocops or as overly concerned with force protection, overly scared by the people around them, and therefore eager to use force to establish dominance. And of course, to the degree that there's any truth in that, it was certainly supported, it seemed, by the British experience in Basra, which, because of its ethnic composition, was a completely different kettle of fish.
It was a Shia, predominantly Shia area in the far south of Iraq.
Exactly.
Quite far from, not only from Baghdad, which had all sorts of troubles, but from Tikrit, the last holdout of Saddam's people and of western Iraq.
Right.
Anbar province, yeah. Right. Which.
But precisely, and also it's a region, I mean, this Basra has had, you know, the Shia south had two fairly major revolts against the Saddam Hussein regime. They were both brutally crushed. So it's not surprising that they felt a little bit differently about the invasion than around what was called then the Sunni Triangle. So one shouldn't be surprised that there was a higher degree of compliance or acceptance of what the coalition was doing.
I remember at the time reading about how the British were, you know, patrolling Basra wearing, you know, berets and criticizing the Americans for wearing, you know, helmets and Oakley sunglasses, yeah, and looking very intimidating elsewhere. That, like, you know, sort of, you barbarian Americans, you don't get it. This is the way to do things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a big story at the time, and it really, I think, highlights how little I'll say we, because I'll include myself in that, I understood about the nature of the challenge. Because, of course, your headwear is not in any way tantamount to victory, loss, or whatever. I mean, you're not going to win a campaign by changing a hat. You know, but there was a notion that, okay, the Brits have done this, and they know the way to do this. And, you know, look at them now, they're almost instinctively changing the posture and everything. And now we're basically in the home stretch, if it weren't for the Americans, of course, who are wearing sunglasses. I mean, you know, it's silly. What was missing in all of this, of course, is, I mean, go back to the whole idea of congruence between strategic, operational, tactical, a strategic direction that would give any of that type of hearts and minds stuff meaning. The Brits in Basra, yes, they tried to normalize, you know, the situation, but failing completely to recognize that there was no normal to which to return. You know, they had to establish a new normal, new politics, new governance, new modes of control, and none of that really took place. There was very little preparation for it. There was a lot of improvisation as a result, and the end result, as you can read in the book, is quite catastrophic in many ways.
So what happened in Helmand province in Afghanistan, where the British also had primacy?
Well, I think, in Helmand province, what we see is, again, surprisingly, given the experience in Basra, an intelligence failure going in about the nature of the campaign. There was, a very infamous statement by one minister that, if we go to Helmand and leave again without firing a shot, we'll be quite okay with that, which, of course, you can read that many ways, but I think it speaks to an assumption this was going to be quite a much more permissive campaign than it obviously turned out to be. And from then on, I think the lack of a overall campaign plan to render logical the application of forces, or at least given some sort of political direction, meant that the units that were sent out there really never dominated the situation to the degree necessary. Instead, they sort of improvised along with their own institutional strengths, or according to their own institutional strengths, never quite applying their train in reflection or in a way that aligned to a campaign plan or strategic direction. Another aspect here, of course, is that Helmand was a part of a NATO campaign, and I don't think NATO was ever entirely clear on what it wanted to achieve in Afghanistan. And Britain, as many others, have been the victim of that. It was only really after a few years that the campaign plan in Afghanistan became sufficiently clear. But by that point, of course, it was also an equal desire to get the hell out of there. So it's an inauspicious time then to surge and try to do counterinsurgency when you have an expiry date of around 12 months. It just is quite hopeful.
One of the points that you make in your book, which is, I thought, very interesting, was you note that the strategic context of counterinsurgency has changed in recent years, I mean, most notably with Iraq and Afghanistan. What did you mean by that?
Well, counterinsurgency, I mean, if you look at the semantics of it, of course, it's to counter an insurgency. And an insurgency, of course, is an attempt to unseat the established government, or at least to establish some sort of separation from it. So counterinsurgency, by its very nature, is a conservative and pro-status quo activity. And that makes sense if you think about the colonies or the old campaigns where, Britain would be faced with some attempt at independence or national liberation and would seek through a variety of means to maintain its control, but perhaps modify it in some way. Still, the contours of political control would remain unchanged. That is an entirely different proposition from what we've done or tried to do in Afghanistan and Iraq, which is fight our way in, impose a completely new order, and then defend it against all of those who lost through our attempt to do precisely this. And my co-author, Robert Engnell, has a very good article out on this point in a recent issue of Joint Forces Quarterly, that in a sense it's almost the West that is the insurgents. It's almost the West that are the revolutionaries and in going into these countries and seeking really to change very firmly established social and political norms within just a few years.
So would it be fair to say then, just to make sure I understand what you're getting at the tactical and operational levels, these may be very comparable to, counterinsurgencies of yore.
Yeah.
But at the strategic level, they're quite different. Would you see this then as fitting within, at least with regard to the United States, and I'm largely uninformed on this with regard to Britain, but with regard to the United States, would you see the fact that no one seems to have noticed this point as being a reflection of the accusation that the United States, likes to optimize what it does at the tactical and maybe to some degree at the operational level, that we think that, good tactics and maybe good operations add up to something strategic, when in fact that's not necessarily the case, that we like to think, because we're really good down at that level.
Right. I do think that there is that type of tendency. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily an exclusively American tendency. I would also tie it to really the historiography of counterinsurgency from the past. Most of the records, books, memoirs of past counterinsurgency campaigns are focused on the military component or aspect. Perhaps because most of those writing were either in the armed forces or interested in military affairs. So coming back to Malaya, for example, you have many books on jungle warfare, on the tactical and operational evolution of approaches. Yet far less has been written about the political process of galvanizing or coming to a new compact, a new political understanding. Again, the strategic level that gives everything else meaning.
When you say far less has been written, do you mean in terms of the participants wrote fewer sort of memoirs, or do you mean far less has been written by historians and people since then?
I would say, I would say both, but particularly if you look at the scholarship that most counterinsurgency scholars would look at, far more has to do with military affairs on the ground, hearts and minds in this village or whatever, than it does with a political puzzle that it really is the essence of counterinsurgency. In this case, just to bring a little bit of specificity to what I'm saying, in 1948, the reason that the insurgency kicked off was because of mismanagement, I think it's fair to say, of the ethnic question in Malaya. That's to say, the Chinese in the first formulation of statehood were included, but because of the animosity by the Malay and also the Indian ethnic communities towards the Chinese, they were then excluded. So there was this sort of, rise in expectations and then exclusion, so that the Chinese were motivated then to take up arms and try to establish their rights or more radically, but seeing as this was a communist revolution, to establish sort of a Soviet in Malaya. But it really, there was a strong ethnic component to it. So it's remarkable to me, it's almost a criminally under-researched area, how the Malay elite was led to accept Chinese inclusion within the new Malaysian state. I mean, if you don't do that, if you are unable to change the animosity, and it was a very deep-seated animosity, then nothing you're doing at the tactical operational level will really matter. It's a tactical solution to a strategic problem. So I think it has a little bit to do with who writes the stuff we read on the past campaigns, and what does that lead us to believe or expect from future campaigns.
Would it be fair to say, then, that in some sense this problem was foreseeable, that it was sort of built in, let's put it that way? So military people, they write, whether it's memoirs or history later, it's exciting and it's sexy, mm-hmm. right? And there's not particularly any security issues associated with writing it. Mm-hmm. Politicians and policemen seem kind of boring, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so they don't want to write their memoirs because no one will buy them, and it's much less sexy and exciting to research them. And on the intelligence side, particularly with regard to the British, who have very draconian rules on this right. sort of thing, right. those memoirs don't get written, and those records, those raw records, don't even get opened, mm-hmm. so there's nothing to look at there. And so the historians are left, looking at what there is, which is a predominantly military-dominated body of both the memoirs and yeah. also declassified records.
I think that's absolutely the case, and it's really part of a larger problem. I mean, even the term counterinsurgency sits very badly on the civilian side of the fence. I mean, here in the U.S., I think we've achieved some buy-in in the State Department and so on, but really the notion that counterinsurgency is an effort where the military supports rather than is supported doesn't quite have the traction that it should, which is worrying, of course. The other main difference is that whereas in Malaya or other colonial campaigns, there was a colonial infrastructure of civilians and politicians and diplomats and engineers and agriculture specialists or whatever.
That really had a lot of weight.
Right, exactly, and not just quantitatively, but also qualitatively. Now, of course, we don't have that. So not only are we overly focused on the military part of the puzzle, but when we send forces into the field, they also tend to be predominantly military. That leaves us very short from the type of multifaceted response that would be needed in these types of cases.
You place a great deal of emphasis in your book on learning institutions. Mm. Is the British Army a learning institution?
Well, I'll go out on a limb here, and I'm just going to say no. I don't think
overarchingly.
All
right.
It's good
to have the courage of your convictions.
Yeah. At this point, I would, if I had to choose, I'd say no, because unfortunately, within the British Armed Forces, there is a high level of or some degree of paranoia, which is not completely strange, given the budgetary cuts that the force has been undergoing for many years.
What are they paranoid about? I'm not sure I follow you.
Embarrassing headlines, exposure, causing political problems, being caught doing something that they shouldn't. So, for example, even writing a book like this is complicated by the fact that interviewing active duty servicemen is well, it's not entirely forbidden, but there's a whole process that you have to go through.
It's effectively discouraged.
Right, exactly. And people are quite cautious about talking, about saying too much. They don't want to have their name included in most cases. Interestingly, you know, when I wrote a book on the U.S. military previously, I did not quite encounter so much concern about those things. So that's one level. And then for the MOD in particular, I believe fear of ministerial embarrassment, or again, fear of being made to look the wrong way, has resulted in a high degree of censure of even the British Army's own publications on these issues. So it's difficult to learn when you have those types of impediments. That's not to say that there aren't reformers who are trying, and there's been some very commendable efforts, particularly since 2009. But we have to remember 2009 is a full 6 years after the invasion of Iraq. UK troops had already left the country by the time these innovations came to light. The question is really within a very austere environment whether those efforts at reform will stay, whether they will live on, or they will be sort of swallowed up, particularly as the UK forces also withdrawn from Afghanistan. But I think that if I were to make any recommendations to the United Kingdom or the British military, it would be to instate a far more open culture of communication and sort of sharing of experiences. This has been attempted within the Force Development and Training Command, which was again created in 2009, very much modeled after the U.S. TRADOC, Training and Doctrine Command. But it's going against the larger institutional flow of the organization, and is facing some challenges as a result.
Are there, just to close then, last question, are there implications for the U.S. military? Your book is about the British military, but the U.S. figures in a lot of this. Mm-hmm. Are there things that the U.S. military can and should learn from your work?
I think so, absolutely. And we kind of wrote it with that in mind. Again, we mentioned the foundations of counterinsurgency theory are very much British, but applied elsewhere. But more fundamentally, the last chapter of the book deals with different strategic options for the future. How do we maintain strategic or expeditionary effectiveness now that we're so traumatized, I think it's fair to say, by our recent experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, and perhaps rightly so. And we highlight a few different options, one of which is something that I hear talked about a lot in the United States, is the notion of indirect approach, doing more with less. And whether this is something that's dominated by special operations forces, or whether something that applies also to general purpose forces, this notion of doing things indirectly has become quite sexy.
Well, let me probe that here for a minute, because the indirect approach is a phrase, of course, that you know is most naturally associated with Basil H. Little Hart. Mm-hmm. Do you mean it in the same way that he does, or what do you have? Give me a little more on what you have in mind here.
It's a very fair question, and I think part of the problem with the indirect approach is that it has never been quite truly defined. The way it's talked about in the book, and also in sort of the circles that we're trying to communicate with, I guess. It's the use of far fewer forces, sometimes just advisors rather than combat troops, to help local forces, host nation forces, do the work for us, so to say. So the campaigns that are trotted out at this point are usually El Salvador, when the United States officially deployed 55 advisors for around 10, 12 years and allowed the host nation structures to take the lead in the counterinsurgency campaign against the FMLN. Or you could look at the Dhofar campaign, and I mentioned previously that until recently it had not received much attention. It is receiving more attention now because it's a precedent then for an indirect approach of how Britain could operate with far fewer soldiers or just advisors on the ground as they did in Dhofar. And achieve some sort of strategic results as a consequence. The problem that we have, and I think this applies directly to the United States, is that indirect approach sounds very good, but what is it an indirect approach towards? What are we trying to achieve? I mean, it does not get around the very fundamental problem of crafting and implementing a strategy. And that is the same whether you look at El Salvador or if you look at Dhofar, for example. In Dhofar, I don't want to belabor the point, but in the initial years, tactically and operationally, again, with British advice and assistance, you had the trappings of a fairly effective-looking counterinsurgency campaign. But because the leadership at the time was so absolutely draconian, repressive, and stuck in sort of the 19th century, there was really no way in which you could translate tactical and operational successes into something resembling victory. So it was only after a coup, where the son actually overthrew his father,
Sultan Qaboos.
That's right, exactly. That you had then an ability to move the strategic component or aspect of the campaign in line with what was going on tactically and operationally. And from then on, of course, you see the years for which that particular campaign is now remembered. So the strategic problem is unavoidable, whether we're doing things indirectly or directly. So sitting in the back seat in no way makes counterinsurgency easy. And that conceit, I think, if it's allowed to live on, will get us into more trouble than we can possibly foresee, seeing as in one sense or another, Iraq and Afghanistan were also initially intended to be indirect. There was never this idea that the U.S. would have direct responsibility for security for many years on in Iraq. That's one implication. I think we need to look much more than it, not just how do we work with host nation forces, how do we augment the numbers, but more importantly the capabilities, but also how do we marry up that type of security force assistance to a political program of affecting strategic change, armed politics, which is, after all, what counterinsurgency is all about.
Well, you've given us much to think about, to put it mildly.
Well, thank you very much.
The book is Counterinsurgency in Crisis, Britain and the Challenges of Modern Warfare by David Ukko and Robert Agnew. And David, thank you so much for joining us here at Gone Topics.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.